You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good evening, everybody. It's lovely to see you all here. I am Jessica Strand. I am the director of the public programs at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. This season, we've focused on resilience. We've chosen this for obvious reasons. Each of us has had to grapple with the complications, hardships, and circumstances that the pandemic and its multiple variants have presented. We've all had to be resilient and flexible in order to keep our lives moving forward. Tonight, we're lucky enough to have Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist Andrea Elliott here to discuss her extraordinary book, Invisible Child, Poverty, Survival, and Hope in an American City. Her book, though written about a family in New York, speaks to many families across this country who are dealing with homelessness, poverty, hunger, drug addiction, and racism. In 2013, Elliott published a five-part series in the New York Times exploring homelessness in New York City. She told the story by centering on Dasani Coates and her family. At that time, Dasani was 11 years old, living in a rundown Brooklyn shelter. Elliott followed the family, covering their story for nearly a decade. This seminal work explores both the tragedies and triumphs of the Coates family, while all along helping to clearly paint a larger picture of the deep inequities in our culture. Before I introduce tonight's guests, I do want to talk briefly about the Library Foundation and its role. The Library Foundation of Los Angeles is instrumentally involved in supporting many programs at the Los Angeles Public Library. Tonight, I'd like to point out a number of programs that might be very helpful to people. LFLA provided funding to help Los Angeles Public Library launch The Source more than 6 years ago. Today, The Source continues as a one-stop shop of resources and services to help homeless Angelenos transition to independent and a supported living. Services are also available for eligible low-income residents. All services are free. Another program I'd like to mention is Tech2Go, a hotspot loan program which provides internet access to families and households that lack these services. The mobile hotspots are easy to use and allow users to connect their laptop, tablet, and other Wi-Fi-enabled devices to the internet. In the coming months, the Los Angeles Public Library will also provide circulating Chromebooks to patrons for long-term loans. For more information about these programs, please check out our links in the chat. Now let me introduce these two exceptional guests. Andrea Elliott is an investigative reporter for the New York Times and a former staff writer at the Miami Herald. Her reporting has been awarded a Pulitzer Prize, a George Polk Award, a Scripps Howard Award, and prizes from the Overseas Press Club and the American Society of New Editors. In 2015, she received Columbia University's Medal for Excellence. This is her first book. Andrea will be in conversation with Dr. Robin J. Hayes, who is a staff writer on the forthcoming series, Sandokan. After completing her studies at Yale and NYU and working as a human rights activist in Chiapas, Central America, and Cuba, she directed, wrote, and produced the award-winning documentary Black and Cuba and produced the prize-winning play 9 Grams. Robin recently authored the critically acclaimed book, Love for Liberation, African Independence, Black Power, and a Diaspora Underground. Please welcome Andrea Elliott and Dr. Robin Hayes. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for having us. And thank you everybody for being here with us tonight. We are Zoomtastic because we refuse to be isolated from one another. And that is a wonderful thing.
Zoomtastic is my new favorite word.
Zoomtastic. So Andrew, you and I were talking a little bit, getting prepared for tonight. And I kind of want to just pick up a little bit where we left off because we were talking about Brooklyn, which is my homeland. I am a third generation Brooklynite. My grandparents met there on a stoop in Bed-Stuy after World War II. They came to the city as part of the second wave of the Great Migration. And you know, like Dasani's family and her ancestors, you know, did their best to achieve the American dream despite the obstacles of being working class and Black at the same time. And so each of those things have their unique challenges, as you described so vividly in your book, and then together sometimes those obstacles can be insurmountable in terms of maintaining family integrity. And we talked a little bit about how part of the challenge in many cities like Los Angeles and New York is that a lack of access to intergenerational wealth means a lack of ability to stay in your hometown. And can you talk to us a little bit about your what you've witnessed with that in studying this family and through your reporting over the years? Because you also did a lot of work in the Muslim American community in the Bronx before this project, right?
Yeah, you know, thinking out loud a little bit right now, but you've inspired me to just, because you mentioned my work on Islam and threading through both of those projects, the stuff that I did on Islam in America was years of work, mostly in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. is Brooklyn, right? So Brooklyn was the kind of, it kept pulling me to stories of people who were both very rooted and somewhat adrift in terms of just security, in terms of belonging. And I think if I were to say that, if I were to kind of try to find one word to summarize what this book, Invisible Child, which is about Dasani Coates and her struggles as a homeless child and her coming of age, is about, because, you know, it touches upon so many things. It touches upon poverty and structural racism and addiction and the role of education and government surveillance and the power of family bonds. I mean, that's just to list a few of the issues that I think her story forced me to kind of understand in a new way. Mm-hmm. But what I think brings them all together is that this is a story about belonging, and it's about who gets to belong to a place and who doesn't. And in 21st century America and in gentrified Brooklyn, that place is Fort Greene for Dasani. And she's designated as homeless. She's living in a shelter when I met her in 2012 as an 11-year-old with her 9 family members in one mouse-ridden room. And she would be seen as, and she was, by outsiders or even teachers at her school or people who didn't know her family history, as a kind of transplant, as like one of these kids who just goes from shelter to shelter. And she had been, you know, going from shelter to shelter. There are people who study, you know, really looked at the impact of this on homeless children. And one of the most striking ways of describing it I found was what Mindy Fully Love calls root shock, which is what happens to plants when they're uprooted from their soil repeatedly. So there's truth in that. Dasani had been to many shelters before she landed at Auburn, but what wasn't apparent to people who saw her coming in and out of the shelter was that she was more at home in that neighborhood than most of the neighborhood, except for long-timers like her family. And that's mostly people who are in the projects, in the two projects surrounding the shelter, and which were once one major public housing complex called Fort Greene Houses. She went back 4 generations. And this is at a time when Fort Greene was, you know, a lot of people were flipping houses. There was just this whole new kind of community that had arrived that, because they were homeowners, felt a real sort of both sense of belonging, like a true, like they were stakeholders. Mm-hmm. But I would argue Dasani was more at home there and more in her right to be there than almost anyone. I mean, she had a story in her family or a piece of history and literally on every block. And so that's what your first question makes me think about.
Yeah. And it's so interesting you bring up this different, you know, we have different points of view on rights and belonging, right? Like, what does it mean to be a stakeholder? In our country, we consider that to mean not so much that you're even a citizen or a resident, but that you have private ownership over something, whether it's a land or business, right? That means you get to put your flag down and call it home. But I don't know if you recall this, but a few years ago, Spike Lee was talking about how some new neighbors in Fort Greene, because he's, you know, born and raised there, Do the Right Thing is very
called,
much
called the cops on his dad.
Called the cops on Bill Lee, who, you know, is featured in many on the soundtrack of many Spike Lee films, is a well-respected jazz musician. He's just doing his work as he always done, practicing his horn. And they call the police because too much jazz. You know, and so this question of, you know, what is, how much should a neighborhood transform,
right,
to suit newcomers,
right,
right, is one that's very palpable in very many neighborhoods around the United States, in New York, in San Francisco, here in Los Angeles. What might you say? Because, so, you know, some people will, you know, let's be honest, have a more open ear to you, a New York Times Pulitzer Prize winning author and journalist, than maybe to Spike Lee or Bill Lee. What might you say to those newcomers?
No way would I get more respect than Spike Lee, but okay. Thank you for that. I'll take it, but no way.
Not so much. I mean, I just think an open ear, right? Because some people, you know, feel like, okay.
An open ear. Okay.
You know, I've spent the money, and, you know, like you said, in Fort Greene, if you have your own brownstone, you spent $2 million, you know, or you borrowed $1.8 million. It is quite an investment. You might have an idea of what your neighborhood should be like because you're at that price point. What might you say to them based on what you've observed and learned in all your reporting?
In Fort Greene, after the series ran, this is a five-part series I wrote on Dasani before, well before it ran, actually. I was like, I have to keep reporting this because I felt like every emotion that is available to me as a human being in the course of this project over the, it turned into 9 years, actually. It was almost a decade that we were together. And, but the one thing that I almost never felt was boredom. And there were a lot of boring moments, by the way, when hours spent in line. And at one point I fell asleep on a bench and Dasani took a picture of me asleep with her mom. We were both passed out in the DHS intake office after 10 hours, but I never felt that I had arrived at the truth, the ultimate answers. And so I answered this question with a lot of, with that caveat that I'm only speaking from my own experience as a person who also lives in a gentrifying neighborhood in Harlem, and as a person who spent a lot of time in Fort Greene. When the series ran, a lot of folks reached out. I mean, yes, on the one hand, they're owning, you know, a lot of them own millions of dollars worth of real estate, but they tend to be, at least the folks that I encountered, and I think this is a fair, maybe reductionist, but fair summary of the Fort Greene scene, is, you know, pretty liberal, or at least centrist to left-leaning folks, some progressives, and not, you know, it's not like going to the Upper East Side and having the same conversation. And again, Upper East Side has plenty of liberal. I'm just saying, New York has all its corners have their various personalities. And a lot of people reached out from the neighborhood and said, I can't believe that this was going on right in my own neighborhood, that the families were living like this, and that kids were, you know, in so much pain right near us, that we could, is there anything we can do? What can we do? What we can do? And I tell the story now, I'm realizing, a little bit because of the venue tonight. My answer was not like, look, I'm not going to give you policy prescriptions. There are a lot of people hell of a lot better at that who are trained to do that. I am not. That's not my profession. But I can give you a very quick thing you can do. You can just walk two blocks away into the Whitman Library every day, starting around 3. And all you have to do is spend half an hour doing some math drills with the kid who's desperate for just any kind of attention, or, you know, maybe you have some snacks. The librarians are saints at this little library. It's a tiny library. It's a very, very important, historically very important library in that neighborhood that Dasani's grandmother also sought, and great-grandmother sought refuge in before she began doing the same thing. School lets out. You don't really want to go home. It's too crowded. A lot of the time, I think the perception of kids like Dasani is that they don't want to be with their parents, that they'd rather be outside on the street. It's not their family, it's their the conditions of their housing and just literally space. So many things I started to realize I had taken for granted in my life pre-Dasani. Things like the lack of noise. Well, I'm used to some level of noise in Harlem, but I mean, where can you imagine trying to, I tried to bring people into that room, but you know, just 10 people in a room for more than 24 hours is a very, very hard exercise. So it's just the lack of privacy, the lack of peace, the lack of quiet and space. And, you know, so these kids would stay outside, and one of the safe places aside from school was this library. And all you have to do is just go to that library, and there's like it's like 40 kids sometimes would just show up, and they didn't necessarily need anything. They just wanted some attention, or maybe you could read with them. And it was like, I mean, I don't know if anyone ever did what I said, but I just feel like that is the kind of connection that needs to happen at a sort of cellular human level in these neighborhoods, I think, in not such a formal way, right? Because I think when people think big sister, big brother program, 2 years of my life, I can't commit, and then they never do it. It's like doing their taxes, or they put it off, or something that's just like it's too big and my life is too busy. But anyone has time for 20 minutes a week. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you do that, you're not just, I don't even see it as giving back. I see it as getting engaged. It's, mm-hmm. You're getting a hell of a lot from those kids. They're amazing. Mm-hmm. I can't say enough about the really magical people that I spent years around, Dasani and her peers and her family. So it's a two-way street. And I do think that people like to move to neighborhoods and feel like they're part of the neighborhood, and yet they don't really see how they are seen as outsiders. And I mean, I was just constantly reminded of that by Chanel, who made it, you know, just enjoyed reminding me of every possible turn. This is Dasani's mother, that I was, you know, I had just a very big learning curve to immerse myself in her world. We could talk more about that, but it was a long process.
Yes, I think that's a great segue. Let's talk more about, because I think that is, you know, it's very powerful to me when you talk about, you know, when people are alerted to the problem, or the problem becomes something very emotionally real to them, they want to fix everything in the system at once. And if they can't do that, they feel like, okay, well, I don't want to do anything. But of course, you know, if a lot of us just decide to work on one little pebble cumulatively, yeah. Right, that's going to make a big impact. And so that can be in your neighborhood with the unhoused kids. What can you do that is sustainable and small? You know, and it might start at your local public library. Like, that's so simple. It's so achievable. Right.
Yeah.
And it's right in your neighborhood, and you will probably not eradicate all, you know, homelessness for children, but you may very well make a strong impact. And so we can all think a little bit about what pebble we'd like to move.
Yes. Right?
That can make a huge impact. That's very powerful. But I think that other part of the awareness, right? Some of us are, I mean, it's so interesting to me. We are both Latina, you know, very differently. Your mom is Chilean, right? And my stepdad is Afro-Venezuelan who raised me. And so, like, we have the different kinds of kinship ties. And, but, you know, and just I like to say that because, you know, Latinx people look all different types of ways, and we don't always see that.
Of course.
And so, but, you know, that awareness, or thinking that you need to be aware. For some of us, we're more hypervisible because we're queer, or we're Black, or we have browner skin, whatever it is, we're disabled, whatever it is, we're more hypervisible. So we're used to being keen about our surroundings and thinking about what people think of us. Some of us who fit into, you know, more of what society tells us is the norm, we don't necessarily have those experiences. And so we don't think about how, you know, how is our presence disruptive? how is our presence maybe not necessarily always welcome? So it would be very, I'm very interested to hear from you what you learned from Chanel in terms of thinking of yourself, maybe for the first time as an outsider and what you needed to learn.
I mean, I will tell you this is as you were talking, and I find almost everything you say worthy of writing down. This was before you all joined us. some of Robin's words, I was like, why, where were you in my final editing stages? Like, that's a brilliant way to put it. I was just trying to imagine as you were describing that, what it's like to be a person who has always been so in the norm that they don't comprehend how they are seen. And because that's like, this is the way I work as a journalist. Like, I'm always trying to kind of, I get fascinated by like people who are very different from me. I have always been a very privileged outsider, is how I would put it. My mother came to the United States from Chile in the late 60s, married my dad, and they had met in Chile. And then the dictatorship happened, the coup, and her brothers and our family basically fled for their lives. And I was born inside this kind of exile community that was forming in Washington, D.C. in the 70s. And we were living on a very isolated farm in Virginia. And my dad was working in government. He's American from Buffalo. And my mother and my grandmother basically were raising me on the farm with my older brother. And our first words were Spanish. And the people that came and stayed with us sometimes months at a time, well, the two uncles are the ones I'm thinking of, for the most part, were there having left, their entire lives were destroyed and they were trying to remake their lives in America. And I just remember at an early age going to school and always feeling like I was the one, especially in Virginia, you know, in this particular place where it's like everyone was white and not Latina, you know, that I was the one who came from the family that was different. But, and then that continued as I grew up, you know, in different ways. But I think what it did was it helped me. Well, it didn't help me or not help me. It made me a person who is always looking outside of myself and trying to figure out friend groups, human groups, you know, what people bonded and why, and who is on the outside, who's on the inside. And I think that's just like a thing that a lot of journalists probably share. Aside from ADD, there's certain things that I feel like we all have in common. And that, I mean, anyway, so we're adrenaline junkies. We do very well on deadline and we tend to be really curious and some bordering on nosy, which is, coming back to Chanel, her chief complaint about Drea. I'm Andrea, my name's Andrea, but I was always Drea in high school and she just automatically started calling me Drea. And I just warmed, me to just hear that. I just felt like she got a part of me in a way. It was weird, but she just found me to be very nosy, because of course it's my job to ask lots of questions. But we wouldn't have gotten anywhere if I hadn't been willing to answer a lot of questions. And so I think our relationship was very much a two-way street. It was very much a dialogue from the very beginning. But the way in which I was constantly, I was an outsider for sure. First of all, skin color, number one. Second, you know, coming from this establishment newspaper, but also what it represents in terms of social capital. And just having been privileged enough to go to college and, you know, I took out loans, I remember, to go to grad school, but my parents helped me out with it in the end. And I just was able to do these things that made me a different kind, a more advantaged human. And she saw all of that. And the thing about Chanel is she is, and I've said this for years, and only until people could read the book did they start to believe me, unless they'd met her. My friends who've met her agree. I mean, she is brilliant. I mean, she is just kind of, she's, she has a mind that I can never completely figure out. It's always surprising me. And she's prophetic in the way she talks about things. She's poetic. She's just a person with a really great brain who didn't get a chance to go to school in the way that she would have liked to. She had to drop out of high school. She only got as far as the ninth grade. And so, you know, she was just, I think we felt very much like we can connect, you know, we can connect about almost basically anything. We can talk about anything. There's no subject that's off the table. But when she would come into the Times, for instance, when she came to visit, because I felt it was really important to bring her into my world too. She, you know, it was hard. It felt like she didn't belong. She felt like she didn't belong. And then of course I was mostly in her world and I knew I didn't belong. So that noticing how the other is different was always in the conversation. And I think the most important thing I would say about just the status of outsider is that it's a teacher for the person, especially who's there to try to tell the story. It's something to pay attention to. It's not something to get around. And I don't believe in, you know, the fly on the wall theory, you know, that eventually enough time will pass that I won't be noticed. I think I was always noticed. I just came to be noticed in a different way. I mean, 8 years with a family is a lot of time on the street. A lot of it was on the street. Mm-hmm. And so Chanel would talk about how I was, you know, she would always talk about my street cred in Whitman and the house and the projects and where it was on, if it was like up or down, like depending on what I'd done that day. Like if I showed, you know, she would get so mad at me. She was like, you'd be a terrible spy, because I'm very transparent, as you can probably tell with my, you know, I can't really hide. I'm terrible at lying. I can't hide things. And she'd be like, poker face. And then she's like, Drea, you're killing me out here. You can't do this. Because, you know, everyone assumed I was either a snitch or a social worker. And for some people, those are the same thing. Not to diss social workers, they're incredible. But, you know, it was, if you're light skinned, you are someone who's most likely been paid to show up. And either the job involves monitoring and surveilling, controlling in some respect, this neighborhood, or it involves what you might feel is a do-gooder job, but it is not, it's a job. It's not. And so everyone wondered, what was this girl's job? What was she really all about? What was her purpose? So try as I might, and my, you know, I wore this, like, you know, this hat and, you know, just my, whatever, my New York attire, my beanie and my reporter boots and scuffed up jeans or whatever. I am who I am. And there's no hiding that. What was important for me was mostly just to notice that, because I think, and then to get out of the way of that, to get myself out of my own head as much as possible, and to just absorb the world around me that I was witnessing. And I think, if anything, I feel like this book is an act of witness. It's an imperfect act of witness, but the more I could get out of my own way and just try to do the thing I'm trained to do, which is, you know, to almost in a maniacal way, you know, absorb every detail. And I do it with a lot of things. I don't just write notes or I use audio recording and video recording. I have 132 hours of audio recordings. I used a pen, actually, that I still use. Dasani would call it my spy pen, and she would use it as a microphone sometimes and pretend she was on the news, which is the opposite, because the pen is supposed to be quietly taking down audio recordings as you write. And there's, you know, dozens of hours of video because I don't trust my memory. And I wanted to be able to write in a way that was authentic and that felt very true to what I saw and what happened. And dialogue was very important, again, to get out of the way of the voice and to let people, you learn so much with dialogue. And there's a lot of dialogue in this story for that reason. But I think so Chanel kind of got used to me messing up and maybe showing too much on my face, but then also she could see that I was riveted and interested and there, mostly just there, and wanted to understand, and also really noticed and was able to talk. I was willing to and wanted to talk about the ways in which my race would maybe change the feeling in the room if we were at the welfare office or in the hospital, and how it was cause for alarm sometimes in the room with the neighbors or people who were on the inside and who had no reason to trust me. And this just was like a really important part of it. Because I think, I do believe that this story, and I don't even like calling it a story because it is real. Dasani's life is real. And what I witnessed is something that became a book, but this, let's just call it the subject, is very much Invisible Child. It's about an encounter. Mm-hmm. It's about this encounter between these two very different cities. Mm-hmm. And I belong to one and she belonged to the other. And so I think the fact that we were living out that encounter in our relationship was informed the book.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Well, two, on that note, you have a passage that you'd like to read to us.
Yeah.
And something that really struck me was the persistence of hope in all the family members, you know, despite, you know, what you describe in the book, extraordinarily difficult circumstances that never let up. So there's the root shock that you talk about, but also just the day-to-day constant threat to survival. And despite that extraordinary pressure, and it's a kind of pressure that if you've not lived with that level of scarcity, it's very difficult to even process or comprehend. The extent to which they remained hopeful about their family as a unit and about themselves is something that is really, really extraordinary. So I'm looking forward to hearing this passage again.
Yes, thank you. To give you some context, this passage comes towards the end of the book. And by then, Sunny's family has been in and out of homeless shelters, finally got Section 8 housing, moved into a stable home. Dasani got an incredible opportunity to go away to a boarding school. And so she left home. And she was always sort of her mother's right hand. She was a really central cog in the wheel of that family system and was really relied upon to hold it all together, and did it in concert with her stepfather and her mother, but it was a system. And whenever there's a big change to a system, there are, you know, consequences. And I think what we saw there was when Dasani left and went to school in 2015, 10 months late, by 10 months later, the wheels had completely come off. Not just because Dasani had left, for a number of reasons. And really a lot of them were just incremental things that had happened that just had the misfortune of colliding, small things that then turned into catastrophe, which is so what often what happens with people who are just consumed with the act of survival, that, you know, you can get waylaid by the smallest thing because it just knocks out the only reserves you had. And so her siblings and Dasani were removed from the custody of their parents and placed in the foster care system. Dasani was still in boarding school when this happened. And she knew what was going to happen next because they all dreaded this. This was the only thing that they always, all their lives, thought they would be able to avoid and truly labored to fight, was being put in the foster care system, because mm-hmm. they knew that meant really bad things a lot of the time. And it did wind up being devastating for her siblings. And she knew that. And so she felt really, she felt like she couldn't stay in the school. She couldn't feel whole anymore. And she had to go back. She went back to New York and went into foster care. I won't give away much, but I will say that she and her closest sister, Dasani, was named after the bottled water that had come to Brooklyn's bodegas right after she was born, and that represented this sort of new gentrified consumer base. And her mother saw the bottled water. She herself had been named Chanel from the perfume ad that her mother saw in a magazine ad in Brooklyn at a time when that was the closest you could get to this other life. But then she was holding this bottle, so it was getting closer and closer. Her closest sister was named Aviana, after Evian bottle. And they were like twins. They were born 11 months apart and they could like read each other's thoughts. They'd grown up together, but the foster care development just drove a huge wedge between them and they didn't talk for over a year. Here's the passage. Forever Family writes Dasani on December 3rd, 2017, above a photograph on Facebook showing three new friends. They are throwing gang signs. Dasani, now 16, knows that her estranged sister, Aviana, will be rankled by this. To write Forever Family is Dasani's way of saying the opposite, that nothing is forever, not even family, that one's sister can be replaced as easily as one's blood, which is not thicker than water, as their mother used to say. In the photograph, Dasani wears a red bandana in allegiance to the Bloods. One family is poised to take the place of another. Dasani has not seen Aviana in over a year. They last exchanged texts 5 months ago, but Dasani knows how to break her sister's silence. Precisely 2 hours and 35 minutes after Dasani posts the Forever Family photo, Aviana appears on Facebook, clicking a digital hand. The hand waves at her sister. Dasani waves back. "Hey, sis," writes 15-year-old Aviana. A feverish correspondence follows. They agree to meet the following weekend at a subway station in Queens. They are both nervous, so Aviana sends detailed instructions. Dasani must take the A train to Broadway Junction, then the J train to Queens, to the last stop, get off, go upstairs, and then meet me at the turnstile. Queens is not Dasani's turf. She asks for the name of the station, which worries Aviana. Nothing can be left to chance. Instead, they settle on Broadway Junction, which is impossible to miss. "Got you, sis," Aviana writes. On the afternoon of December 10th, Aviana leaves her foster home in Queens, and Dasani leaves her foster home in Staten Island. They check their phones. "I'm on the train," writes Aviana. "Me too," writes Dasani. By 1:28 p.m., they are minutes apart. Both trains arrive, and the sisters dismount. They cannot find each other. Aviana writes that she's here. Dasani writes that she's coming upstairs. Aviana writes that she's coming down. "No," Dasani writes, "she's coming up." "Where are you at?" Dasani asks. "Aviana's at the turnstile." "Come to the escalators," writes Dasani. The thread stops. The station stops. Two sisters are crashing into each other. They have no words. They hold each other like refugees who have crossed some unseen border. Everyone is watching. "Mind your own damn business," Dasani manages to shout from her sister's impossible clutch. She cannot breathe like this. No one hugs like this. "You're holding me too tight. Let me go. Let me go." No one lets go. They stand like this for minutes. They already know their next move. The A train will come, taking them to downtown Brooklyn, where Chanel is waiting. The train is coming, the very train that their grandmother used to clean. It pulls into the station. The door is open.
That is, I mean, going back to what you were saying earlier about how.
It's like, it really gets me to read it. And I normally don't like get emotional like this, but I read this with Dasani by my side at a private gathering. Aviana, Dasani, Chanel, Papa were all there. And, of course, we all just started crying. And then I looked up in the entire room. I'd lost it. So I thought, well, we're not alone. But it's unreal what they went through.
And I think that we hear so much about the obstacles that unhoused folks and unhoused families have to face. We hear the statistics and we hear the facts. And I think sometimes we can be led to believe that emotionally it's not landing as hard on them, right? And this is, it's called the empathy gap, right? Where we get accustomed to certain groups of people and their suffering. And so we think, the pain must be somehow less, but it's not. Your sister is your sister, whether, you know, your dad is an MD or a homeless addict, like either way, right? That's a bond and it's a close bond. And, you know, when you are separated from your sibling, of course, that's painful and traumatic and destabilizing, and that will stay with them. You know, they have the good fortune of being able to maintain that relationship, but that's still, I'm sure, left a mark, you know? And so I think you're right.
They're very, very, they're fine. They're just as close as ever. And they live together now with their mom and stuff, but
that's great.
They repaired, but I think the damage was the years of being without each other. I think you're right. I think people inure them, like, they inure themselves, if that's the right way of putting it, to pain. We'd rather not see it or imagine that the person who's homeless on the street right in front of us is actually suffering as much as we might imagine, that it's easier in some way to think, oh, they're tough, or they've chosen this, or because once you start to look, you can't unsee it.
Yes, you can't unsee it. And also, many of us are closer to that life than we would like to admit.
Yeah.
Right. Even those of us who have the degrees and have the, you know, the white collar jobs and the social capital, as you described, you know, very few of us have reserves, extensive reserves that can really guarantee us freedom.
Well, going back to
fear.
Yes. I mean, going back to the observation you made earlier about the family safety net, the kind of intergenerational wealth that is something that a lot of families don't even understand is actually a safety net. It's understood in a kind of casual way. It's like, well, if Uncle so-and-so loses his job, he can always spend a few months in our, you know, guest room. So they don't really understand. So this is a safety net that is taken for granted, that was denied a huge portion of Americans, right? Mm-hmm. By virtue of class and mostly race and systemic structures that created huge barriers to advancement. Mm-hmm. And this is all in Dasani's story. And, you know, but the other thing I think that we often don't see is precisely what you just named, which is the physical toll and the psychological and emotional toll that just the act of daily survival takes. I mean, it consumes you. It's, mm-hmm. There's nothing left. Reserves, there are no reserves. It's Chanel so consumed as I watched her, you know, with just the idea of like, how am I going to get through this gap between when my food stamps are gone and when they replenish, and I don't have any cash and I've got to feed 8 kids. And she did it. She figured out ways. She just always found a way. She was constantly working in that sense. Mm-hmm. It was just this nonstop anxiety. And once you're in that space of just managing, it's Maslow's hierarchy, you know, and at the bottom is, you know, just food and shelter. And then, you know this, but I mean, and then you can only reach the things at the top if you have the things at the base. And she never had the things at the base, so she couldn't enjoy, you know, concepts such as high self-esteem and sense of belonging to her community. And, you know, she wasn't able to rest enough to do that. So yeah, it's something we don't see unless we're very inside it or we've lived it, right? I mean, you can never understand it the way that a person who has lived it understands it, but many people haven't even really been exposed to the daily grind of poverty in the way that would make them see it differently.
Yeah. And I have to say, as someone who, I mean, my family was unhoused when I was a child, and as somebody who has lived it, I think your book does an excellent job of really shedding light into the interior life of people who were experiencing it, and not just the social conditions that caused it. It was something I really appreciated about the book. And I think I'm not surprised how much compassion it's inspired. And speaking of that compassion, it's time for questions from people who are Zoomtastic with us this evening. All right, let's start with Kathleen asks, what is your relationship with the family currently?
My relationship is close. We talk almost every day. I didn't, you know, it's funny, a lot of people, I think, assume my relationship would end. Maybe that was the healthy assumption, you know, in someone's work when they do something and then they finish the project, the work ends. But I never saw this as, this is going to sound funny to say, because it was very, very, very hard work, but it never felt like a job. It felt like an incredible privilege. And, you know, I considered myself a student and I was there to learn and I was constantly learning and I never wanted to stop in a way. And so I don't see my relationship with them as doing anything, but I would hope deepening even more over time. And they know my kids. I you know, we are in each other's lives. Dasani's doing pretty well. She's in college now and studying business and working, and her mom is also working. So they're on an upswing and they're renting in the Bronx. So I feel like things are going pretty well for them.
That is great to hear. Very heartening to hear. Let's see, Liz Flock asks more of an authoring question, which I think is very interesting. Were you aware of the book's central idea from the start? Did it change throughout? And this is a provocative question, I think, for all authors. How did you know when you were done?
Okay, let me start there. So that scene that I just read to you was what I thought was the ending. And then something else happened. And so then I wrote again what I thought was the ending. That's also in the book. And then more things happened. It's just, I think at a certain point, I realized that I was doing myself a disservice and the book a disservice if I would just continue to like forever report it. But I also had been well into the writing at that point and saw that it wound up, I think, ending in a place that felt like the right place. I read it, you know, I read the whole book over the course of 5 days to Dasani and Aviana, because I wanted to see their reaction. And I thought it was part of the fact check process, but also was important to me to witness them hearing it and making sure that they knew what was in the book. And I got to the last page and Dasani said, okay, actually she read it. She read the last paragraph out loud. I have it on video. And then she said, this is the end? And I said, yes. And she jumped on top of my dining room table and started dancing. And I don't think it's because she thought I was such a great writer. She was just so happy that we were done, that I was done reading to her for 5 days. But yeah, the ending was, it felt like the right ending. But it is, I mean, to answer the first question, I laughed a little bit when you asked it, because I mean, I just remember so many times in this process being like, oh my God, what is this book about? It's about so many things at once. And I don't even know how to describe it. I remember being at a writing program, a residency, where I went to park my kids with my mom and took a few weeks to just try to churn out a bunch of the book. And I was at lunch or dinner, and someone asked me what the book was about. And I don't know what I said. And the next morning, someone who had been there was like, so I was there last night. I heard your explanation of your book. Have you ever heard of this thing called the elevator pitch? I think you need an elevator pitch. Like, you need to just be able to summarize it in under 30 seconds, like one sentence, just. But I think that's a healthy place to be in. I think as you labor through a story like this, especially a story as complex as this, and one that is as deserving of one's attention and time and discipline. And I read so many books in the process of writing this one, sometimes an entire book just to be able to write a single paragraph, right? To be able to feel like it was, I got it right. And I think not knowing is part of the process. It's like an inevitable, it's not something you, I would be nervous if I felt like I knew what it was all along. Mm. I started out thinking it was a story about a homeless child. I wound up questioning the very notion of homelessness as a state that should, you know, as a label, because I think it becomes this way of categorizing a person based on the lack of a physical thing rather than on what is present for the person. And I think it's very important that Dasani was, you know, she needed to say she was homeless in order to qualify for shelter. I'm not saying that we should get rid of the label, but what I'm also saying, I'll read you this quote. This is a quote that I carry around with me that she wrote to me when she decided she just couldn't stay at Hershey and she needed to come back home. And her mother kept saying, there's no home for you because everyone's in foster care. There's no home for you in New York. She said to me, home is the people I hang out with, the people I grew up with. That, to be honest, is really home. Family who have had my back since day one. It doesn't have to be a roof over my head. At Hershey, I feel like a stranger, like I don't really belong. In New York, I feel proud. I feel good. I feel accepted when I'm in New York. So it's really a story about a true New Yorker who happens to not have a home.
Yeah. And that's, it's very powerful. I mean, from the mouths of babes, we always say, right? I mean, what a powerful perception for her to have is, you know, and something that made an impression on me was, you know, that strategy of the Hershey boarding school, which obviously has its heart in the right place and wants to provide opportunity to young people who are at risk, you know, but we know that survivor's guilt is real. We know that we need our familial connections to feel whole. It's so key to the human experience and human development. And yet so many programs for lower income children is about how do we pluck you out? I was part of one of those programs, the Better Chance program, which is like, well, we'll take you and that's it, you know? And so that observation I think is key in terms of thinking about solutions is what are we doing for families and communities, not just individuals, right. You know?
Right.
And at the same time, I live in a very affluent community here in Los Angeles. I'm not gonna name names because I don't wanna give anybody to get mad. But, you know, there's a lot of expensive homes and, you know, people don't really talk to their neighbors, you know, and we know behind, you know, the doors of beautiful multi-million dollar homes doesn't mean there's always a good family relationship.
Either. Oh, yeah.
You know, so it's very, very astute just showing that intelligence goes from Chanel to Dasani clearly, right?
Yes. You mentioned. Definitely.
Yes. So another question from Sarah Parga is how did you, and this is something I think is a challenge for everyone doing ethnographic research, how did you cope emotionally with switching back and forth from mm-hmm. Dasani's family, spending time with them on the streets, and your own?
I mean, I probably did a clumsy job of it. I struggled with it a lot. I grew up, you know, with a mother who, my mother who's from Chile is a therapist and we're from DC and, she spent many years as the mental health director for a free clinic for, Latinos in Adams Morgan before Adams Morgan became gentrified. Mm. It was a place where there was a lot of, crime on the streets and shootings and stuff. And my mom was just beloved in this neighborhood and she'd park her car in this dark alley. I remember going to work with her sometimes and being like, I can't believe you come home every night alive. She would park her car in this really dark alley and she's, you know, like light skinned and obviously an outsider, but not an outsider in the sense that everyone in need in the neighborhood knew her because she'd been there for so long. She'd been doing her work. And I think, you know, that she had a lot of patients die. You know, this was during the AIDS crisis. A lot of her work happened during that time. And she'd come home and she kind of modeled for me this, like, this ability to just, like, when I walk in the door, I'm leaving a big part of myself outside because it's not fair to my family otherwise. I have to learn to shut that off. I don't know that there's a healthy answer to this. I think I struggled and I still struggle with it. And I can't say, therapy is useful. I don't know. All I know is that I didn't have a choice. I didn't feel like I had a choice, but to be true to my work and also stay as present as I could in my kids' lives. And bringing them together helped. I brought my kids with Dasani and her siblings together a lot over the years, and they see each other still. And that's felt like, okay, these two parts of myself, there's cohesion there because, you know, they know and love each other. So, but I'm not saying that that's the answer. And I really don't have perfect answers for any of this.
Well, it sounds like your process, though, which, I mean, you did get the book done. It's done okay. <It's> your process was really about being as transparent as possible with the family and having an open door and then spending the time, you said 8 years, right? Really spending the time to build that relationship. And so, you know, that... It doesn't sound like there was a lot of switching. It just seems like this became a huge part of your life.
It did. It did. But there's no question that the switch wasn't even a physical switch. In the sense that I spent a lot of time with them and a lot of time with my family and went back and forth all in the same city. It was a less visible kind of thing that I knew inside me that was the thing we were talking about earlier, that I knew that if I wound up without a home, I had a home to go to, which was my mother's home. I never had that weight on me that Chanel had. And so knowing that I'm in the life of this other mother who has so many hurdles to constantly jump, that I don't face myself was, it was just really hard. I don't have a better word for it. I just thought about it a lot. And I think a lot of it, it changed the way that I came to see myself and my surroundings, really. I don't.
A little bit more about that? Like,
yeah, I can totally tell you more about that. I mean, I think a big part of this book is how the look that I take at the child protection system and the separation of the children from their parents and the impact of that. This is a country that had an awakening around child separation with migrants. And we collectively, there was this just sort of like outrage. And what was so interesting about that moment was that it coincided with, in my work, watching this happen to this family and thinking, my God, this is happening every day and it's been happening for decades in mostly in urban America, and nobody has been saying the same. It's a slightly different thing, but the act of separating a child from the child's parents, usually in cases of neglect, not abuse, can feel like an act of violence, and it has huge, huge consequences. You know, the trauma that is inflicted is often irreversible. Anyway, I entered into this world where those kinds of things were possible in my work. And yet at home, I was, you know, I have an accident prone kid. She's just very, she takes lots of risks, and she broke an elbow at a trampoline park. She broke an ankle skateboarding. She's just always putting herself out there, and it doesn't go very well. And I'd be in the ER with her dad, and we would be like doing our like reporter questions, like boom, 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 boom to the doctor. Like, what do we think? And it only later, when I had been in enough emergency rooms with Chanel, and I could see how different it was for her, how scary it was for her, not just because her kid was sick, but because in addition to her kid being sick, she was being watched And she, if somebody had shown up with a broken arm, she was a suspect. There's a way in which parents of color in this country are monitored that is astonishing. Now that I've kind of understood how widespread this is, I can't believe I didn't see it earlier in my work or even in my life. But, you know, those are the things that I think we take for granted. It's just like, we don't even have to think about that often as parents of lighter skin and privilege in that, in those circumstances. And I think about it all the time now. So it's just, that's just one example.
Well, unfortunately we are out of time, but I have really enjoyed meeting you. This is the first time we're meeting, Deborah. Really enjoyed meeting you, the opportunity to speak. And I don't know if we will have closing comments. I'm sure someone told me, and I...
Well, if we don't, I just want to thank everyone and the foundation for a wonderful opportunity.
Thank you. I mean, this was a remarkable conversation. I'm sure we're all going to think about it through the rest of the night and on into weeks to come and years to come. And thank you both for being here. It was illuminating and moving. And thank you all, the audience of all those out there watching Aloud this evening. And thank you, Robin, and thank you, Andrea.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.